I arrived in Vietnam July 4th of 68, and I went in the army first in 67. The scenario leading up to that is when you signed up for as a freshman boy at South Dakota State University, and I suppose at University of South Dakota in those days, it was mandatory. If you were male and physically able to walk, you were enrolled in ROTC, Reserve Officers Training Corps. I didn't know too much about what that was, but it seemed like a good deal to me, and it was mandatory. So, where do I, you sign here, and here's where you get your uniform. First 2 years of ROTC were mandatory. After that, you signed to go into advanced ROTC, where they paid us $40 a month, well, as a college student, to take one run credit course, and with the idea that the promise that you would get a commission as a second lieutenant in the United States Army upon graduation. Air Force had a similar deal at South Dakota State University, too.
Okay, so tell me why you decided to go that route.
It just kind of evolved that way. I don't remember a conscious decision, but it seemed like the right thing to do at the time. And I made that decision to sign up for the advanced ROTC in about 1964. And few of us had really heard much about Vietnam in 1964. If it had been hot, if I had heard about it, I don't think it would have changed a thing for most of us, but for a few, it would have.
So that wouldn't have been a deterrent. You wanted to be a part of the military.
Absolutely, absolutely. And realistically, when a guy is 20, 22 years old, you're virtually 10 foot tall and bulletproof in your own mind anyway. And since we didn't have all the propaganda that came out later, discouraging people from the military, it was a logical thing to do, and I would do it again exactly the same way.
When you went into Vietnam, then you said it was 1968. Now this is really when everything is gearing up in
Yes, it is.
Vietnam. How did you feel when you got those orders? I mean, were you scared, or were you really just the invincible young man that you thought you were?
A person tends to become a little bit more realistic about that time, and no, not scared, but apprehensive perhaps. And perhaps more fear. I got married in 1967 too. Immediately 3 days after college graduation, my wife, my fiance, pinned on one of the lieutenant bars. My mother pinned the other one on. And as she learned more of the military commitment, she probably became more apprehensive than I did. But I was here getting all the training, and I didn't see too much to be afraid of. There wasn't, from what we saw, that much to be afraid of, and no reason to ask yourself, is there a way out of this? No, it never came up. It wasn't not a factor.
How was it for your wife and your mom, particularly your wife, when you did leave?
Left from here at Sioux Falls. We traveled to, first of all, to Fort Gordon, Georgia, for officers basic, signal officers basic. And then to Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, for school there. And she very much enjoyed living on or near the military posts and had a great time, and the military life was very attractive to her. And then we spent 6 months, 5 months perhaps, at Fort Lewis, Washington, with a troop unit there in continuing training, but as a lieutenant platoon leader. And she enjoyed life on the military post there as being part of the military community. And then after that, we moved back here to Sioux Falls, back to near home, and she wanted to get into a school, so we enrolled in a school at McKinnon Hospital, recommended to us by a friend. And then I left, and then we found a house for her to rent and left. A month or two later, her cousin's husband in the Air Force was ordered to go in the same direction, and so his cousin came here, and they decided to rent a larger house together, so they left the little house, and then they spent the rest of the year together, she and her cousin, with similar experience and husbands overseas, and so it was just a natural, just the way life was. The only real tough time was the day I left. Now, we just moved into this new house here, rented a house here, and bright and early the next morning, we pack up, and I've got all my gear packed and in uniform, and go to the airport, drive our your old Dodge Charger to the airport, and not yet paid for, and drive it to the airport. And I remember I drove out there, and she rode with me, and we got out there and went down and got the luggage and checked everything and kissed her goodbye and walked onto the plane. And she went back to the car, and then realized that I had the car keys in my pocket. And I flew to Denver and to San Francisco with the car keys in my pocket, and she's back here at the airport. She arranged something. I never did hear exactly how she did that, but I think she called the landlord of the house we'd rented and asked him to use his master key to get into the house and get the spare key somewhere in the house and bring that out the airport. I think that's how she did that. But only at that time, only when she found out she didn't have a key, did she break down. And she had a good cry there at the Sioux Falls airport at that point. Mm-hmm. Joe Fossfield. It wasn't funny at the time, but it was very funny.
Now it is, yeah.
Yeah. Later, mm-hmm. we got together in Hawaii twice during the next year for R&R and had a great time there and learned how to enjoy that, getting off of Honolulu and off of Waikiki Beach to get out and see the island or the other islands, and had a great time there both times.
Tell me, when you got into Vietnam, the main mission you were charged with and the locations that you were traveling to.
Okay. When I first arrived, again, you fly over there in a chartered 707 with 300 other soldiers, none of which you've ever met before. Nobody you've met before. All strangers. You get to know each other on the plane. And then I had orders for the 9th Infantry Division as a signal officer in the Army Signal Corps. Okay, there's two areas you could typically serve with that kind of training. Number one, you could be a communications officer, signal officer, for a combat battalion, either infantry or artillery battalion. Or you could be an officer, serve in the signal battalion, which is all signal people, doing supporting the whole division's operations with communications. By the luck of the draw, that's where I was assigned, to the signal battalion. My first 6 months or more, I guess just 6 months, I was with the operations office. I was the assistant operations officer and the intelligence officer. So my job became to find out through briefings and whatever information I could get from all different sources, where is the operations of the different parts of the division going to be tomorrow or next week, and then plan signal communication support for them, get radio telephone communications out there, get the FM repeater in place, get whatever we needed to in terms of support for the infantry and artillery.
So you went in ahead of the infantry?
Yes, kind of, except we went in terms of flying there to find out where they were going to be, and then as they came into an area, we would bring in, sometimes by helicopter, sometimes by truck, whatever, a radio telephone rig on back of a 2.5-ton truck. You can fly that in by helicopter, too, the rig, not the truck. And, set up communications for them in the area of operations.
Okay. So you were probably all over the place then.
Yes, I enjoyed visiting, traveling much of the Mekong Delta by air, helicopter, bootlegging a ride by whatever route you could, or sometimes helicopters assigned to us, because that's how you're going to get your people or your gear there, chartered, so to speak. Sometimes we went by truck, sometimes we went by boat, sometimes we went by our jeeps, and sometimes went by foot, depending on where you're going to. And used all those methods and really enjoyed it. Another good duty for a lieutenant is when you're a company pay officer. Because then in our company, and well, not in headquarters company, but later when I was in C company, we had people supporting operations throughout the Delta. So you'd fly out to wherever you had two or three men and pay them once a month and fly somewhere else. So I think a couple times, two times, maybe three times I was assigned as the company pay officer, and just you hitch ride in whatever helicopters and get always have an armed guard with you. I was carrying, I guess I was carrying a 45 and a M16, but the armed guard also carrying the same things because you're carrying the money bag and literally a bag of cash, but it wasn't American dollars cash, it was military pay certificates or MPCs, which is what we all used as money there, never having the greenbacks.
Did you see, you probably saw a lot of fighting and a lot of violence being in all these different areas. I imagine a lot of people were trying to shoot at you, too.
Well, yes, but I just was very fortunate. My duty was quite good, and I was never in a situation where I feared for my life in a big time. I didn't have that experience. We talked earlier about the ammunition dump blowing up. I was the lieutenant when I was in C Company. Then I was a lieutenant in charge of C Company's perimeter reaction force. So when we'd get hit, the division base camp get hit hard, I was the guy who was told to take, and it wasn't C Company, it was the whole battalion's perimeter reaction force, I guess. So I was to take one platoon from each company in the battalion to the perimeter to reinforce our guards already out there. And typically we'd spend the rest of the night there, and we spent some long nights out there. I remember one series of nights which resulted in a 40-hour day between naps. I mean, you know, 2 days and two nights or whatever, and it was 40 hours before I was able to sneak a nap in somewhere. And that got to be a little trying. And after 40 hours without sleep, you really get, you're not worth much. And you get to be easily irritated, and your judgment is poor, and
I imagine you get jittery and paranoid,
yes,
too.
Yes, that too. Yes, you do. And you kind of just get to the point where you say, to hell with it, you know, and maybe get trigger happy and things like that. So that was not a good situation, but I know other men in similar situations were on duty far longer than I was. So 40 hours for me was just my one longest day, and that was memorable for me.
I imagine so. And you brought back some really great artifacts, you could say. Tell me about the shotgun.
The 12-gauge shotgun.
Yes.
Our unit, and I got to admit, I wasn't right there when we captured it, but our unit captured 22 identical, or nearly identical model anyway, 12-gauge Ithaca shotguns made in Ithaca, New York, USA. And we determined, actually, different of us applied for and latched on to just individual weapons among those, and I happened to draw a good one, and I managed and registered as a war trophy. One key part of it was determining, before we can even think about registering it, was this ever a U.S. military weapon? And so we had to do some research and check with the armorer and check with whoever else we checked with. I don't know, it was 40 years ago, so I don't recall who else we checked with. We determined that the Ithaca 12-gauge had never been a U.S. military weapon. And so therefore it's eligible to be registered as a war trophy, which is then what I did. And had a white tag hanging on it and carried it for a month and used it and enjoyed it. And a good weapon to have. That plus the 45 caliber, the officer's standard hand weapon was a good combination. Anyway, okay, the exciting thing that we were talking about that I think you want me to get to was bringing it home. Okay, so I bring it home.
I was curious how you read my mind there. That's perfect.
I carried, I remember we were at Dong Tam, and I turned in the rest of my gear and my other weapons and everything else at Dong Tam, and you keep one set of BDUs. We call them fatigues, I guess, and it wasn't BDUs. Jungle fatigues. Anyway, carried one set of jungle, wore the one set of jungle fatigues, and my Jeep, and with my replacement lieutenant there with me, and driver, and then a couple other troops and a deuce and a half, and they were going to pick up some gear or something up there, too, at Tonsonut Air Base at Saigon. Anyway, so I'm on duty in uniform carrying the weapon right to Tonsonut Air Base. Then I unloaded the weapon at Tonsonut, changed into khaki uniform, the Class B uniform, and got on a plane. Might have spent the night there at Tonsonut, too. I don't recall, but that changing uniform took a little time. Got a chance for a shower. And then you then get into a plane. So, and they chartered 707, just like the ones we arrived in country on, what we went home on. And again, getting onto a plane with 300 other men, none of whom you've known. Even after a year over there, nobody on the plane did I recognize. Except I think I did spot one guy that might have been on a plane that came over with me. And we recognized each other, and a little worse for the wear and a little more suntan, but we recognized each other there. Anyway, so then I'm carrying this 12-gauge with no case of any kind, and just had a white tag hanging from the trigger guard that identified as a war trophy and a number on it and whatever. And carried it up into that 707, put it up in the overhead luggage compartment there, the same place you put your carry-on bags today, and flew from there, from Tanzanut to probably to Guam, and then to Hawaii, and then to Travis Air Base in California. And I suppose I left it in the overhead compartment as we got out, because I had no reason to take it out of Guam, and we trust your other soldiers just to not mess with it. It'll be okay there. And we all got out of the plane, and, you know. Anyway, so we're at Travis Air Base, and you get off and carry the weapon onto Travis Air Base, and you, as I recall, we spent the night there. As an officer, I would have had a room, a small overnight room there, in a BOQ of some kind. And left the weapon locked up in that room while I processed out of the Army the next day. And by the end of the day, I was out of the Army and kept still in uniform, still got another day's pay or whatever as you, well, in fact, my crew would leave. So I was officially still in the Army, but I'd signed all the papers to get out. And then I took the same 12-gauge and my other luggage, got into either a taxi or a bus, I don't recall, but went over to across San Francisco to San Francisco International Airport. And then the experience began. Now, you've heard a lot of other soldiers been given a hard time in 1969 by war protesters or whoever in San Francisco. San Francisco was an unfriendly city to soldiers. I did not have a problem with that because, first of all, I was carrying a 12-gauge. And that's, you know, it tends to discourage people from giving you a hard time. I probably stopped, had a beer in the motel, or not in the motel, in the airport lounge, and that's where, you know, you typically would get a problem, and I didn't have a problem, no problem getting service and whatever, and then carried that 12-gauge all the way down through the airport, checked my other luggage, kept on carrying this one as overhead baggage, because I had nothing to check it in, no suitcase, no big case to put it in, and I didn't want to let it out of my hands. So I figured, well, I'll carry it right in the plane like I did back in Tanzanut. And I carried it all across San Francisco International Airport, attempting to appear inconspicuous. That was a problem. And just envision yourself doing that, carrying a 12-gauge through the airport in 1969 or today. And there's no way you can appear inconspicuous or walk casually as you would walking down a cornfield, a corn row, hunting pheasants. It's not the same in San Francisco International Airport. And anyway, nobody gave me a problem. Everybody stared at me. And, you know, I'm sure they're wondering, you know, is he one of us, or is he one, you know, and is he authorized to have that? Anyway, so I carried it all the way out to the airport, out to the last gate, the final gate to get onto the plane. And there, a stern-looking, slightly older lady looked me in the eye and said, "Young man, you are not going to get on that plane carrying this rifle, the shotgun, this gun, whatever. You're not going to get on there." I kind of wanted to get on the plane pretty bad, so I said, "Fine, okay, then darn it, find me something to put it in." And they came up with a long, thin, foam-lined packing box of some kind. That a short riot gun is not a long shotgun, not a big hunting weapon, so it fit in there very easily. It's a legal weapon, long enough to be legal, is not sawed off, but it's a riot gun, so you would not use it for hunting pheasants or ducks. Anyway, so I gave it to them. They checked it in the luggage there at the gate, and I got on the plane and flew to Sioux Falls and picked it up here again as my wife met me at the Sioux Falls Airport, and I remember I picking up the luggage there, and I kind of jokingly told her, I brought this for you, Reba. This is yours. And she looked at that and opened the box and, "What am I going to do with that? Hunt pheasants?" anyway, it's been a good time. She did shoot it one time, too. Mm-hmm. But it was just fun bringing it home. That was really a real experience, bringing the darn thing home and proving to myself, seeing how far I could go with it. You know,
one thing that I find interesting about that story is that you chose to stay in a uniform. I mean, granted, you're carrying a 12-gauge, but a lot of the soldiers, they changed out of the uniforms. They didn't want to be identified as Vietnam veterans or Vietnam soldiers. They wanted to blend in as civilians because of the way some from Vietnam were treated, being spit on and called baby killers, a lot of really negative attitudes from the protesters that you mentioned outside of San Francisco Airport. Why did you make that choice?
I'm not aware that at this early stage in the war, 1969, that soldiers did change out of their weapons, out of their uniforms. Maybe they did in 71, 72, or after Kent State. But at the time I came back, it never entered my mind. And I think we were all told that, yes, you're authorized to and will travel in your Class B khaki uniform all the way home. The other part is that we didn't have much civilian clothes with us. You had one or two changes of clothes, maybe jeans and some slightly better dress pants, but you didn't have very much in the way of clothes to wear. And just never occurred to me to make a change of uniform. And I don't think hardly any changed uniform at this early stage in the war, 6 to 9. And that was about mid stage of the war. Later they may have done that, but I'm not aware that ever happened. On the other hand, I did find out pretty soon after I got home that really it was not popular to identify yourself as a Vietnam veteran. And I remember I put it on my resume when I applied for a job with IBM and Northwestern Bell and a couple other companies and went to work with IBM, and they identified me as a seasoned Vietnam veteran. But I didn't identify myself in my own mind as a veteran for a number of years. It just, you know, wasn't popular to do it, and it never occurred to me that I'm one of those guys. Those are World War II guys, are the veterans. And later, 20 years later, when I was invited at that time to join the VFW, American Legion, whatever, I finally did identify myself in that way. Yes, I knew technically I was a veteran, but frankly, I didn't care, didn't identify myself that way. I remember being introduced at a Chamber of Commerce meeting, in Cherokee, Iowa, by a member of our Army Reserve unit, perhaps 5 years after Vietnam, or 2 or 3 years after Vietnam anyway. And he introduced me as a guest there at the Cherokee, Iowa Chamber of Commerce meeting, coffee, whatever it was. And he introduced me there as a Vietnam veteran. And I remember shaking my head and, yeah, I guess he is talking about me, isn't he? Yeah, I guess I am. Yeah, but it really didn't occur to me until I was told so that, yeah, you are a veteran. It just, you do the things you do, and that's who you are.
Mm-hmm. Do you think part of that is that Vietnam, compared to World War II, Vietnam was an unpopular war, or World War II, everybody rallied behind it and there was great support for it?
Certainly, that's a big part of it, and the idea that there was no welcoming home. My welcome home party was a party of one. And my parents were in Texas, her parents were up on the farm, and so my wife met me at the plane, and that's all I cared about, that's all I wanted. And we called up my parents later and checked in with them and saw them a few weeks later. And it was the Vietnam experience did not identify you as a veteran the way the young men today coming back from OIF and OEF are identified as veterans right away. Mm-hmm. And they're told so, and they sign up in the American Legion, the DAV, the VFW right away, and that's good.
As I understand, a lot of Vietnam veterans, they never joined those organizations.
Many did not. Many did. I joined perhaps 20 years later. And I remember one time I was invited to join down in Alta, Iowa, the Alta Post, because our mailman delivering our mail spotted some things in there that identified me as a veteran. So he, being a VFW member, did mentioned to me one time that invite me to come there and come to a meeting or to join, whatever. And I didn't. I passed on at that point. But then later, you know, a number of years later, I did join and later became an officer in that post, commander of that post for 1 year, and a great experience. But it had to come sometime later. And initially, I don't think in 1969, 70, 71, 72, I don't think very many of VFW posts were looking for Vietnam veterans to join at that point. They had their own club at that point, and happy just the way it was, I'm assuming.
Do you think they didn't want Vietnam veterans because it was unpopular?
I don't know. I really can't comment on that. Mm. I didn't talk with them.
And what value did you find joining 20 years later? What did that offer to you?
The identity as a veteran and helped me grow to the point where I'm extremely proud now, maybe overly so, of being a veteran. And I'm encouraging other people to do the same, and I can help other veterans. A young nephew of mine just back from, 22 months ago from Afghanistan, came back on an ambulance plane to Brooke Army Hospital, and I encourage him in every way I can to identify himself as a veteran and join the veteran organization of his choice, and helped him link up, pointed them to him and him to them, and so I'm really encouraging young officers, young soldiers to do that, to sign up and become members of the organization for the support group. And for what you can gain from the organization in terms of support, and from what you can provide to the organization, share with the organization in terms of assisting other veterans as they return. There's a lot to be gained by all based on membership in these organizations.
How much value did you find just sharing your experience and talking with others who had similar experiences to you?
Well, very much so. I enjoyed talking with high school groups when we're invited to come talk to the high school history class or whatever class it was.
I'm sure they love the 12 gauge.
I didn't bring that into the school. I didn't do that. But we maybe spoke of it. But I don't take this out very many places outside the house.
Well, I think that's all the questions I have for you, unless there's anything you wanted to touch on or any other stories that we didn't talk about.
Well, no, Joanna, we've covered most of it. We haven't talked too much about the people we served with. Today, the military services are men and women. In those days, it was almost exclusively men. I served with some great men, some who have passed on now, but I learned so much from the example set by those people. I went there a very green lieutenant and returned a little bit more of a seasoned officer, and spent 4 or 5 years in the Army Reserve after my active duty time, then got out, and 17 years later, the Army Reserve called me back again to come back in, and I'm very glad that they did. I thought they were crazy calling me back in the Army at age 46. But that next 14 years after that, or is it 16, 14 years after that, were great years in terms of serving in the Army Reserve and mentoring younger officers, men and women at that point. And that was kind of a shock to me to see all these women in the service and in our unit. And not so much in the artillery unit, the one I first went into, but I was a third of 14th Field Artillery, then later up to the 6th Infantry Division Roundout Brigade out of Fort Snelling, and then when it went away, moved down to the 19th, or to a couple different units down in Fort Des Moines, and drilled for about 10 or 12 years in Des Moines, and enjoyed every minute of that. It was a great time and great experience, and helped me become a much better person today than ever could be without the military experience.
And I overlook that because you were in the reserve when 9/11 happened.
Yes. Where would I have been at that time? I was living over here at Larchwood, and I remember when it happened. I remember calling up the unit that day and saying, what's happening? Are you getting any more information than we are? And is there any alert toward activation? And of course, they didn't know any more than I did, just what was on TV and nothing like that coming across in channels. But we're ready. I think most of the people in the unit phoned in and saying, what can I do to help? And based on the military experience, you're just much more prepared to help. You've had the EMT training, you had the emergency response training. You know how to. You know that, yes, when that happens, when something happens, the right response is not to panic and be paralyzed, but rather to step forward and do something, make some decisions, communicate, and take care of whatever the problem, the emergency is, whether it's a car accident, a tornado, or what have you, to just take some action, which I learned that in the military. I might not have learned it in the same manner at all without that experience.